we're going to talk about a very tough topic.
There are many concerns that have been raised in the literature about this reversal drug.
Mortality at 1 year can reach upwards of 50%.
How do we get there? How do we reverse that INR?
The neurocritical care component certainly is challenging.
Using factor seven as like throwing the kitchen sink at some of these patients.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Hope you all are doing well this week, and thanks so much for listening to the podcast. We are down a person this podcast. Yes, Peter is off taking some well-deserved family time, some wellness time for a summer vacation. So joining me on this podcast are John and Rob. Gentlemen, how are you doing?
Doing great. Just enjoying the start of summer. As always, it's freezing in the city, but otherwise pretty nice out where I live in Marin.
Doing well up in Northeast. Looking forward to, in just a week, Resuscitation 2019 kicking off. So looking forward to returning back to Baltimore for some education, some fun, and connecting with the conference registrar. Should be fun.
It will definitely be fun, John. Looking forward to having you down here in Baltimore. I suspect by the time our listeners are listening to this particular podcast, Resus will be ongoing or have just finished. So I think it might be worth having a follow-up podcast here on CCPEM just to talk about all of the pearls we're going to hear next week at Resus here at University of Maryland. Well, let's turn our attention to some education for this podcast. We're going to talk about a very tough topic, and I think it's one that's encountered fairly often. All of us have had patients that come in that we diagnosed with an acute intracerebral hemorrhage, probably something that, if it may not occur every week for you, you are probably seeing this every month. And when these patients come in, the neurocritical care component certainly is challenging, but what makes it even more challenging is when patients are taking an oral anticoagulant medication and then they have an acute intracerebral hemorrhage. And that's what we're really going to focus on for this podcast. And then we're going to talk about how to reverse common anticoagulants in patients with an acute intracerebral hemorrhage. And that is based on an outstanding review article that was just published in Critical Care. Lead author is Dr. Kuramatsu, and it's titled Reversal of Oral Anticoagulation in Patients with Acute Intracerebral Hemorrhage, just published in the last several weeks, as I said, in Critical Care. Now, the authors begin the article pointing out some epidemiology, some background that I think we're all pretty familiar with, in that intracerebral hemorrhage accounts for overall around 15% of acute CVAs that we see in the emergency department setting. We also know that of any type of stroke, ICH really has a significant morbidity and mortality. In fact, mortality at 1 year can reach upwards of 50%. And many patients who come to us with an acute ICH, well, around two-thirds are left with significant functional deficits along with overall dependency. Unfortunately, the incidence of ICH is increasing not only in the U.S. but across the world. And also, the incidence of patients coming in simply taking oral anticoagulant medications is also increasing in frequency. And we know when patients on an oral anticoagulant have an acute intracerebral hemorrhage, they tend to have larger ICH volumes, more frequent intraventricular hemorrhage or extension, and they also have a greater frequency of hematoma expansion. Now, certainly it can be debated, it's a little bit controversial, as to whether hematoma expansion increases morbidity and mortality, but we know that in these patients, they certainly have a higher incidence of hematoma expansion. And as a result, no surprise that these patients have an even worse prognosis than those not taking an oral anticoagulant. So we're going to talk about two big classes of oral anticoagulants and really go through what the latest evidence says, what we should be looking for, and really how do we reverse these critical medications in the setting of this life-threatening bleed. Rob, let's get started with the more common historical anticoagulant, and that is vitamin K antagonist. Tell us what we should be looking for when we see that vitamin K antagonist on the medication list. What do we do?
Yeah, so when we're looking at vitamin K antagonist associated intracranial hemorrhage, it's clear that there is an increase in bleeding complications when the INR is greater than 4. But it's important to note that intracranial hemorrhage can occur essentially at any INR level. So you really do have to pay attention to that specific number. In terms of the papers or studies that have looked at this particular topic, the author of the article that we're reviewing had a landmark article in JAMA in 2015. And in this article, in this study, they basically determined the target INRs and the target times for reversal that we should seek. And in this study by Kuramatsu, again, they looked at a cohort of VKA-associated intracranial hemorrhages, a cohort of 1,176 patients across 19 centers in Germany. And the mean INR level in this cohort was 2.8 with an interquartile range of 2.3 to 3.5. And basically the bottom line in this study was they found that they basically demonstrated that an INR target of less than 1.3 was necessary to reduce the risk of hematoma expansion. And so they're comparing those two groups. Those with an INR less than 1.3 had 27% chance of hematoma expansion, whereas greater than that cutoff, they had about 45% chance of worsening of their hematoma. They also set kind of the benchmark for the time that we should seek to reverse VKA-associated intracranial hemorrhage. And the association with prevention of hematoma expansion was stronger the earlier that you achieved that INR. So in terms of thresholds here, they looked at about 4 hours, and you wanted to reverse the INR within 4 hours. Those who had it reversed in less than 4 hours had about a 20% chance of expansion of their hematoma as compared to 42% for those who had their INR reversed in a time greater than 4 hours. So then there have also been a couple of studies that have looked at the treatment. How do we get there? How do we reverse that INR? How do we reverse vitamin K-associated hematomas and intracranial hemorrhages? And the first study that we're going to talk about was in Circulation. It was about 6 years ago. And this was a randomized phase 3B multicenter open label non-inferiority trial. That's a mouthful right there. But they basically took 202 patients who had vitamin K antagonist-associated intracranial hemorrhage. And the bottom line from this study was they found that coagulation was more rapidly reversed with vitamin K plus 4-factor PCC in a standard dosing regimen as compared to FFP. So in terms of this staggered dosing regimen, what they used was if your INR was between 2 and 4, they recommended, or they used 25 units per kilo to a max of 2,500 units. If your INR was 4 to 6, you would use 35 units per kilo to a max of 3,500. If your INR was greater than 6, you used 50 units per kilo to a max of 5,000 units. And this using vitamin K plus 4-factor PCC resulted in decrease in INR, reversal of INR, in 62% of cases as compared to about 10% of cases when you used FFP. So pretty much that nailed the coffin shut on FFP in terms of its use for reversal of vitamin K antagonist intracranial hemorrhage. Then another study in Lancet about 3 years ago looked at vitamin K-associated intracranial hemorrhages and patients who had INRs greater than 2. And they compared 4-factor PCC plus vitamin K, again, to FFP plus vitamin K. And a larger portion of PCC group reached the target INR after 3 hours as compared to the vitamin K. Similar numbers, about 67% with the PCC as compared to 9% with vitamin K. So at 24 hours, those who were treated were in the FFP randomized arm. They had a greater increase in intracranial hemorrhage volume and 5 times the risk for hematoma expansion. And there have been some other smaller studies, notably one in Journal of Emergency Medicine, that looked at standardized dosing and found that with standardized dosing, you had improved time to administration and decreased cost. So the bottom line recommendations for vitamin K-associated intracranial hemorrhage are, Number one, that you should target complete reversal of the INR to less than 1.3 as soon as possible, preferably within 3 to 4 hours. You should administer vitamin K IV 10 milligrams by slow infusion, and then you should use four-factor PCCs instead of FFP. And a couple of centers, including I think your center, Mike, are looking at fixed dosing strategies over weight-based staggered dosing strategies, and wondering how you guys are using that.
It's a good point, Rob. First off, you did an outstanding job just summarizing where we're at with the evidence and current recommendations for vitamin K antagonists in the setting of ICH. You're exactly right. We have just moved to a fixed dose strategy for PCCs for all warfarin-related critical bleeding. And that's based on a few studies. You mentioned the one out of the Journal of Emergency Medicine where using a fixed dose for four-factor PCC had better dosing, better time to administration, and also decreased cost. So rather than do that staggered dosing based upon someone's INR and body weight, what we've done in the setting of ICH when someone's on a vitamin K antagonist, we simply give them 2,000 units of four-factor PCC. So it's a change we've just made, so I can certainly follow up with everyone and let you know how it's going. But our pharmacy, our P&T committee felt that this was a wise decision, so just implemented it. Now, in terms of another class, or actually several classes of anticoagulant medications, John, I'm going to turn things over to you. I think many of us are pretty familiar with seeing patients on a vitamin K antagonist. And also, many of us are now familiar with seeing lots of patients coming in on either a direct thrombin inhibitor or a factor 10A inhibitor. And as you may mention in the next few minutes, there's not a whole lot of good guidance and literature on what to do in reversing these oral anticoagulants when someone comes in with an ICH. But can you take us through what evidence exists?
Oh, absolutely, Mike. And I think over the past 5 to 10 years, we've seen a large swing in terms of the treatment of a lot of the problems that people have, whether it's AFib or have a VTE or something like that. Whereas even when I was in residency, which wasn't all that long ago, it was oftentimes heparin to warfarin. But now we're transitioning a lot to these, what used to be known as novel oral anticoagulants, or NOACs, but now they're called DOACs, which is just a D instead of an N. Doesn't really matter all that much. But I think the most common ones that we're seeing today, particularly presenting with patients in the emergency department, are the factor 10A inhibitors, which are apixaban, rivaroxaban, edoxaban. Sometimes it's hard to kind of know what the mechanism is, but fortunately, they were kind enough. All of the 10A inhibitors have XA in their trade name, so that's nice. And then the direct thrombin inhibitor, which is dabigatran. So all these medications have similar pharmacokinetic properties, and they have much longer half-lives, which range from 6 to about 17 hours or so. But unfortunately, their activity can't be kind of excluded by routine tests. So things that we might send on any patient who has a concern of bleeding, like a PTT or PT, or even thrombin time, it may be helpful, but unfortunately, they don't have enough sensitivity or specificity at a specific threshold to tell you whether or not there's an actual DOAC effect. In this article, they recommend if it's available, you could consider using dilute thrombin time or eccarin clotting time. But to be honest, I don't think many of us have this available to us, and it would probably be something that would need to be built in a hospital-wide protocol. So probably not reasonable to ask someone to be measuring that until it's pretty well established within the institution and how to use it. But one thing you can count on, if you can't count on lab tests, is maybe talking to the patient or the family member and finding out the timing of the last dose. So this is really important because depending on when they took their last dose of DOAC, you may be able to do some timely interventions. And one of them being, just like with all tox patients, if the drug or the medication was taken within the past 4 hours, you can start off with activated charcoal. And this may provide some ability to prevent further absorption of the DOAC medication. But unfortunately, there's really no evidence regarding the effectiveness of many reversal agents on hematoma expansion, as we're talking about with intracranial hemorrhages associated with DOAC administration. So what we're going to kind of go through quickly is maybe some of the more exotic reversal agents that also come with a hefty price tag, and then maybe a more reasonable approach or things that might be more readily accessible to you when that patient rolls through your ED doors. So the first one, which isn't yet available, but you will probably be hearing about in the near future, is a medication called Sirepirantag. It's basically designed to reverse the anticoagulant effect of heparinoids, so heparin drugs, DTIs, as well as 10A inhibitors. Right now, it's in a phase 2 trial. And what's nice about it is it does have a rapid onset of action. It's a single dose and it lasts for a while. But we'll be waiting to kind of hear more about this one in the near future and then watch as it goes through the trials of FDA approval. The next one, which I think is probably one of the first reversal agents that came out, is the dabigatran reversal agent called idarucizumab. And this one in particular works well for dabigatran-associated ICH. It was FDA approved in 2015, and it's a monoclonal antibody that's a non-competitive inhibitor that binds directly to the drug itself with a pretty high affinity. It is renally excreted, and its dosing is fairly simple. You give it twice, two boluses within 15 minutes of each other for a fairly significant amount of reversal. Now, in 2017, Pollock and his colleagues published in the New England Journal the Reverse AD trial. And in this trial, they looked at little over 500 patients that were divided into uncontrolled hemorrhage versus those needing an urgent procedure. And they found that nearly 100% of maximum percentage reversal was achieved within 4 hours of administration of idarucizumab. So it sounds pretty good. 98 of those patients actually had intracranial hemorrhage, and repeat imaging wasn't mandated, so they couldn't comment really on hematoma expansion rates, but it did seem to work fairly well in those patients. The thrombotic rate, so this is always a concern in any patient population who you're reversing anticoagulation, whether or not they developed a new VTE or thrombosis, and as well as the location of that thrombosis, was about 6% in patients with intracranial hemorrhage. So the findings of this trial suggest that idarucizumab provides rapid, sufficient, and sustained reversal of anticoagulation in patients taking dabigatran. So that's for the DTI. Now, as far as for the 10A inhibitors, there is one medication in particular that was approved recently, and that's andexanet alpha. That was just approved in 2018 and particularly approved for 10A inhibitor associated ICH. So interestingly enough, the mechanism, it acts as a human decoy receptor binding to the active site of 10A inhibitors, and it has a pretty high affinity for it. So it theoretically restores 10A activity and attenuates the anticoagulation effect. So pretty interesting mechanism there. In 2015, Siegel published his findings on andexanet, which was a phase 3 trial in healthy older volunteers, and he compared different dosing regimens, in particular of the reversal drug. And what he found was that 90% of the 10A inhibitor was reduced significantly, but there was a significant rebound effect at the end of infusion. So again, kind of thinking about duration of effect and timing, that was somewhat an interesting finding in the Siegel trial. There is a phase 4 study ongoing, but there are many concerns that have been raised both amongst colleagues and in the literature about this reversal drug. Certainly the hemostatic rebound is a big one, and whether or not the administration should be given over a longer infusion time might be something that we see come out of this phase 4 trial. There are significant prothrombotic complications, in fact, up to 10% in some studies. So 1 out of 10 patients might develop a clot somewhere. Now, certainly if the patient's exsanguinating, this might be something that might be tolerated, but for the lower level bleeding may not be worth the risk. And again, this one has a significant cost. And we're talking about costs. We're talking about tens of thousands of dollars oftentimes for these medications. So cost benefit certainly comes into play, I think, for a lot of us and is worth discussing at the hospital level. And particularly getting back to the ICH patients, data on hematoma expansion rates and clinical outcomes within hemorrhagic stroke patients isn't really all that readily available. So those are kind of the exotic medications that you may be hearing about but might not be actively using in your practice. But there are some options, particularly for 10A inhibitors, and that's PCC. And PCC may have potential to reverse the anticoagulation effect actually quite well. Most of the data currently evaluates 4-factor PCCs, 3-factor PCCs, and FIBA, which is an activated PCC, for rivaroxaban and edoxaban, so two of the more common 10A inhibitors. There isn't any direct comparison for those just yet. But in 2015, Zahir and his research group published in Circulation one of the largest randomized control trials of about 110 healthy patients. And so I think that's pretty interesting that the largest RCT is about 100 patients, considering some of the other large randomized trials we often read about. So again, this data set's fairly small, but it's the best we have that were treated with edoxaban. So this was a single dose of healthy patients or healthy volunteers. And they compared dosing regimens of four-factor PCC effectiveness. And the dose they used was 50 units per kilo and wanted to see how it influenced bleeding endpoints. So the thrombotic rate for PCC in patients taking 10A inhibitors appeared fairly low. So in fact, it was only about 4%, so more than 50% less than some of the other drugs that are out there. So the available data would suggest that four-factor PCC at a full dose of 50 units per kilo could be considered for 10A inhibitor-associated ICH. Now, some of you who are maybe working in some trauma-heavy EDs or very familiar with anticoagulation reversal might be saying, well, hey, what about some of those other medications out there for anticoagulation reversal like TXA and factor VII? Well, TXA, remember, is an antifibrinolytic. So you're kind of going to be working on a different mechanism of the clotting cascade as opposed to directly at the site of where these anticoagulants work in our bodies. But for TXA, clinical data on associations of TXA in oral anticoagulation-associated ICH isn't really all that readily available, but there are groups that are researching that right now, so we'll keep an eye out for that. And certainly for factor VII, some people may be using factor VII as like throwing the kitchen sink at some of these patients. There really aren't any strong recommendations to routinely use it. So to kind of summarize everything that we just talked about, recommendations for DOAC-associated ICH: certainly consider charcoal if the patient will tell you they took the medication within the last 4 hours. So just like most of our tox patients. Certainly if they've taken dabigatran, you can consider idarucizumab. And that's, again, divided in two doses 15 minutes apart. It's fairly effective. That's only if it's available at your institution. And certainly consider four-factor PCC at a full dose of 50 units per kilo for any patient who has an ICH and is on a 10A inhibitor. Now, as far as some of the other reversal agents, I think there's still needs to be a lot more data and research published on these before they go into the mainstream.
John, that was simply outstanding, bringing us up to speed on what we should currently do for these folks. Rob and John, you guys did an outstanding job. Let me just go back and summarize one more time before wrapping up this podcast on anticoagulant-associated ICH. So we have that ICH patient. We see that on their medication list, there is warfarin. It's a vitamin K associated or vitamin K antagonist. We're going to look to quickly reverse that INR and get it down to less than 1.3 as soon as possible, giving IV vitamin K at 10 milligrams via a slow IV infusion. And then depending on where we're at, if we're at an institution that has four-factor PCCs, they are currently recommended over FFP for a whole host of reasons and data that Rob went over a little while ago. And then in terms of dosing the four-factor, check with your pharmacy. Many still have that staggered dosing regimen based upon the level of INR and the patient's weight. And then some of you may be moving to a more fixed dosing strategy for all warfarin-associated critical bleeding. Now, when we have the ICH patient who comes in on a DOAC, John, you just reviewed this, but we can give charcoal if taken within the last 2 to 4 hours, looking at idarucizumab for dabigatran-associated ICH, and then really at present utilizing or considering four-factor PCCs for patients who have an ICH from a factor 10A at a dose of 50 units per kilo. Now, in terms of andexanet alpha at Maryland, we talked about the fixed dosing strategy for PCCs for warfarin. We have decided not to move forward with andexanet alpha, just waiting on additional evidence. And I'm probably going to misquote things, but the number that I heard is a cost of around 40,000-ish per dose of andexanet alpha. So it's not something that we've put in on our formulary for those study reasons along with the cost. I don't know if you guys have added it to your formularies.
No, I mean, it's really not routinely given at University of Pennsylvania. And again, cost is definitely something that we consider, certainly with the effectiveness of some of the other reversal strategies or ways to manage bleeding patients. We've decided largely not to go forward with introducing it just yet. But again, yeah, absolutely need some more evidence before we can sign on.
Rob, how about you?
Yeah, same here. You know, I'm at a county facility, and at this point in time, we're really pretty much using four-factor PCCs. As far as I know, we do not have access to that reversal agent.
Well, gentlemen, this has been a super helpful podcast on a very common condition with an extremely high mortality. So if any of you have any questions for us regarding what we've talked about, current recommendations, current evidence, or this particular article, we will certainly put all of what we just discussed in a handout attached to this episode, but you can always email us through the website. Once again, it's ccpem.blog. Hope you all are enjoying our updated website. I know many of you are taking advantage of our CME option. So glad to have that back and in operation, and so glad that many of you continue to sign up and listen here to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. That's going to do it for this podcast. Once again, I'm Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. Looking forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.